It's the most wonderful time of the year, Christmas. And what better way to get into the holiday spirit than with a Minky Couture blanket? Whether you're gathered around the tree with loved ones, roasting marshmallows by the fire, or just looking for a cozy way to stay warm on a chilly night, Minky blankets are the perfect addition to your Christmas festivities. With a wide range of festive designs and colors, you can find the perfect blanket to match your holiday decor or gift to your loved ones. So this Christmas, make your holiday even cozier with a Minky Couture blanket. Head to MinkyCouture.com now and find your perfect blanket just in time for the holiday. Happy Holidays from Minky Couture.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to episode 27 of the Footmarks podcast. I'm your host, Param Kazi. You can find me at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber. You can find him absolutely everywhere. And our topic for today is, the title is The Team with Six Cups. And that is because Australia have just won their sixth ODI World Cup trophy in Ahmedabad on Sunday in the midst of an ocean of Indian fans. Capacity crowd at the Narendra Modi Stadium in Ahmedabad, of course. And we're going to revisit each of Australia's World Cup wins in this podcast. Obviously, we'll start with 1987.
Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
So, Jared, do you have any recollection of that tournament? I reckon you were quite young.
Yeah, I remember it happened. So, just to give you the briefest sort of memory of Australian sport is now seen as obviously a big deal and, you know, they win lots of things. That wasn't really the case coming into the 80s. In fact, Australia really struggled a lot in the 80s. They won the America's Cup, weirdly enough, at the start of the 80s. But they'd been really good at sport. Sort of talking outside of cricket here, but they've been really good at sport, various things at the Olympics, obviously swimming and running being two that they've been very good at, and sports like hockey and everything else. And then there was this like dip, and the cricket team got crap at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so the 87 World Cup was a big surprise. And that's what I remember, everyone just being surprised that we were in the final and then surprised that we won, because I think we'd lost England just before then, and you know, it wasn't as if everyone was, you know, pumping this team up or anything like that. Right. But you, as a historian, you go back and you have a look at it and you realize it probably shouldn't have been a surprise. It's just that cricket journalists probably weren't taking it all that seriously and didn't realize that the Australian team were doing things that teams hadn't really done before. So it ends up being a you know, I think they have 10 days, I want to say, in Chennai before the first game preparing, right? Which is extraordinary long time. If you think of what Pakistan did in that test series against England, you know, you don't see teams really prepare that much before they go out like that. And they focused on a few key things: fitness, running between wickets, and fielding were three of them. But the other thing that I found when I went back in the history was how much ahead of the game they were on slower balls. So they had... They had essentially Simon O'Donnell, who I don't know if Simon O'Donnell invented the backhand slow ball. I've tried to talk to him for years and I've never been able to get in touch with him. But I would love to know if he was the person who invented the backhand slow ball. But it was him and Steve Waugh who made it famous, and they're both in the same team. And Craig McDermott was bowling big off cutters at that stage. Again, not something that really had taken over, although, you know, obviously Franklin had... invented, or not invented, but, you know, or sort of pioneered that method a little bit before. And then they were very good at just getting batters to hustle between the wickets and not be dismissed. But no one expected, they weren't a favourite. No one thought they were a realistic chance of winning that World Cup. England was still considered the better team going into the final. And Australia just kept doing little things right. And it essentially, that win sets the template for Australian cricket, right? Mm. Because that is the point where they're like, well, if we act professional, we can be better than everyone else. And remember, everyone else in cricket is amateur.
Yeah. Right?
One of the reasons the West Indians were so successful is because they were playing as professionals in all these leagues around the world, whereas most cricketers, even the English cricketers, were really amateur. And so Australia just did a lot of things right. You go back, if you look at it from a batting perspective, Jeff Marsh and David Boone both made over 400 runs in 8 games. Mm. So the two openers made just a ton of runs. Marsh made 200s. He's the first anchor. We didn't even really, I'm not even sure we even used that term when he played, but essentially he is the OG anchor. Desmond Haynes is probably the only other one. Dean Jones, of course, coming in after. Also made 300 runs. So they got like 1,100 runs in 8 games out of their top three. I think Dino played top three in the majority of the games. I think that's right. He got a bunch of 50s and Boone got a bunch of 50s. And then you've got that bowling lineup. So I've talked about the slower balls, which is quite interesting, right? But the other thing that's quite interesting is that in Steve Waugh and Simon O'Donnell, they had two genuine all-rounders. Despite the fact that Simon O'Donnell made 0 runs in that tournament, he could actually bat. He didn't make 0, he made 15. But the point being, again, you know, they had a very long team, and Alan Border actually bowls 32 overs in that tournament as well, and ends up getting the wicket of Mike Gatting with a reverse sweep that changes the final, right? But again, you know, they didn't have their frontline spinner was Tim May, who averaged 53. So they did it with slower balls and all-rounders and a top order that just kept going. And, you know, they had Moody on that squad as well, who would have been another all-rounder they didn't even need to use. So you could see that they were, it was a very traditional way of playing. But the thing is, before that, it wasn't. They kind of invented this. So West Indies had invented a few different things, like attacking the fifth bowler was a big thing of the West Indies, you know, early on. You know, using someone like Viv Richards as a fifth bowler so that you have stronger batting. West Indies were really, really strong on runouts. There's that game, of course, where Viv Richards gets all those runouts to help them win a World Cup. Australia kind of took a bunch of those ideas. And then the other person that they copied was Javed Meindad, right? And Javed Meindad's big thing was, well, hitting a 4, that means I've got to really swing really hard. I'll just chip the ball over cover's head all day and take 2. And so the Australians were like, well, that's actually quite smart, but they took it to another level because Javed wasn't particularly fit. And so they were like, well, if we can run more 2s than anyone else and then stop other teams being able to score 2s, and that template really lasts until 1996 when obviously Sri Lanka changed it up a little bit. But if you're being honest, the Australian template really lasted up until 2015. Right. That was the style of one day cricket. Your top three batted and made as many runs as you could. You chipped the ball around the middle. You had a bunch of all rounders with slower balls and everything else. You made sure you stopped everything in the field. You tried to get as many fit athletes into the side as possible. That all comes from 1987. So it's an incredibly important series for Australia, but it's also an incredibly important series for one day cricket. And the only thing I would say is to go back is I don't think we ever give Australia the credit for one day cricket that it deserves. Kerry Packer made one day cricket what it is today. And this 1987 team actually set the template that was used for years afterwards. So, you know, without those two things, I don't know where one day cricket would have gone. It might have gone in a different direction or anything else. So that 87 team is incredibly important. And it's probably the biggest upset win that Australia has ever had. But this game, this recent final might give it a go for the final. But I think all things considered, Australia was still, at worst, Australia were like 4 or 5 to 1 at the start of this tournament. They certainly weren't 4 or 5 to 1 at the start of 87.
Yeah, that's a quite fascinating insight. I just want to ask you, of course, they lost the Ashes recently at that time, and then they didn't lose till like 2004. But I know your dad doesn't give a fuck about ODI cricket. So was he more pissed about losing the Ashes than winning the World Cup, or happy? What was the sentiment like?
I remember, so I was what, seven? Yeah. What year? Yeah, it was 87, wasn't it? So I was seven. And I remember that the next morning he told me, but yeah, he didn't really. It wasn't a big deal. I remember him being surprised, and I remember having a teacher at my school who was a big cricket fan, who was also really, really surprised. But I think my memory of it was that was what it was. We weren't expected to do well in that tournament. Hmm. It was in India. It wasn't particularly well broadcast, if at all broadcast, back to Australia. Mm-hmm. I certainly didn't watch any of the games. That might just be because my dad didn't turn on the TV, of course, during them. But I certainly didn't watch any of the games, and I have to go back and remember it. But yeah, it was a very, very interesting time, because it came from nowhere. So, you know, now we look at Australian cricket and what we think to ourselves, oh, they're the winners and everything else. That West Indies had won 2, India had won 1, Australia had probably, again, if anything, the narrative should have been that England should have won 2 tournaments, or at least 1 tournament by this stage, and because of the West Indies and Australia, they hadn't managed to get 1, and you would have expected them in the next tournament, of course, to probably go pretty close to winning, and Pakistan take it from there, and then England never play one day cricket again. So it's quite an important moment, because Pakistan and Australia essentially burgle World Cups off England, and that becomes part of the English narrative, right, of them being losers. And the only other thing I remember is Mike Valletta. Does Mike Valletta, is that even a name? If I said Mike Valletta to you, does that mean anything to you?
I know that he played for Australia. That's about it.
Yeah, so Mike Valletta, like, I just want to have a look how many times he actually played for Australia. He only played 28 games for Australia. He averaged 18 in test matches and 32 in ODI cricket. Had a mustache, and he was, I just mentioned that because it was a really good mustache, by the way. he was famous for this big shield innings that he played, where I think, actually it might be on his cricket info profile, 762 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But the other thing that he's famous for is that World Cup final where he basically plays an Inzi-like innings. He comes in the sort of middle order, and he makes 45 off 31 in that game. And that tournament, if you have a look at the stats, as I said, most of the runs were made by the guys at the top. And so the middle order didn't have as much to do, although I think Steve Waugh basically never went out in that tournament, if I remember correctly. But Valletta had a strike rate of 113. And obviously the guys down the order who were slogging would have that, but he was a specialist batter in that side. He might have kept in that side as well. Or was it Greg Dyer? No, it was Greg Dyer, I think, who kept in that side. And so you actually have the template for that sort of Bevan, Mike Hussey kind of player as well. And Valletta was a little bit different, but I think if he played in this in a later era, he probably would have been that kind of player, in that maybe in first-class cricket, not quite at the level of some of the other Australian players, just average under 40 in first-class cricket. But you could see that they had I forgot one other thing that they had. Left-arm bowler, Bruce Reid.
Ah.
Right? So they had a lot of those moving parts that now, you know, they had Craig McDermott, who was bowling really quick, probably one of the quickest bowlers in the world. Then they had the left-arm bowler. Then they had the slower ball bowlers. Then they had the batters who bowled a little bit of spin. They just had a lot of the parts that, looking back, you're just like, this is actually quite a well put together team. But because none of those guys have been successful in, well, other than, you know, a couple of them, hadn't been consistently successful in test cricket, and they hadn't won a lot in ODI cricket either, it just wasn't really thought of as a great team.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I haven't just heard this from you today. I've heard this before as well, that Australian team wasn't all that great. And, you know, India and Pakistan were favorites in that tournament, and both of those teams failed to make it to the finals. And when I was looking at this World Cup and doing my research, I saw that Australia lost only one match all tournament, that 2 versus India. So, Borders champion team. I mean, like you're saying, it probably deserves a lot more credit than it actually gets.
Yeah, do you know what? I think part of the problem was it's the first World Cup not in England, and it wasn't particularly well broadcast around the world. And if you think about it, 75 and 79 tournaments aren't particularly well known either. 83 more so because of India. Uh-huh. But even then, a lot of those games are not broadcast either. And 87, you know, it was just a little bit weird and a little bit removed from everyone. You know, production values, a lot of journalists didn't go over, all those sorts of things. And so on top of the fact that one-day cricket wasn't taken very seriously, I think that was the case. 92 is in coloured clothing and in whites, mm-hmm. and it's very well broadcast. Slightly strange grounds that they play at, but other than that, it's a proper World Cup, right? And so really from 92 onwards, we don't have a small World Cup. 87 yeah. is the last of the small World Cups. And I think that all plays a part in it. You know, also, very, very, very simple point, but 87 is probably the last time before most of the cricket nations start to get some version of cable TV, right?
True.
So you don't always have the access to even be able to watch all of those games all around the world. And so it was a very, very different mood and vibe than the rest of the World Cups.
Yeah, interesting. So just some final thoughts on 87. Of course, David Boone made runs in both the semi-final and the final. And then Craig McDermott was the leading wicket taker of the tournament. You also mentioned how he was rapidly quick at that time. Jeff Marsh also had a good tournament. Who for you in that Australian team stands out as the best performer in that World Cup winning campaign?
It's a really good question because the two openers were outstanding. And as you said, McDermott took the most wickets. I think looking back, it's probably McDermott for taking 18 wickets in 8 games, which is, yeah. you know, Mohammed Shami levels of wickets, right? The only other player I would mention that I don't think gets enough credit, and I realized this when I was going back to do my research, he didn't actually bat that much, which is Steve Waugh only faced 171 balls in that tournament. But he made 167 runs and was only out 3 times. So he averages 55 at a strike rate of 97, right? Down the order with a lot of not outs. But that's a Klusner light level of runs, except for the fact that his top order made runs. But then he took 11 wickets at 26 and going at 4.5 and over. And the other thing about Steve Waugh was he bowled at the death, right? Because he had that big slow ball, and because he was so accurate with the ball, he bowled at the death. And I can't remember. There's a close game that they win. I remember looking at the footage before this World Cup of it. And he's bowling right at the end in a really clutch moment, in a way that you wouldn't really expect, you know, Hardik Pandya or, you know, Jimmy Neesham or, you know, Marcus Stoinis, those sorts of guys. But that's how good a bowler Steve Waugh was, that he was more like, at that stage, we now know him as this test grizzled legend, but he actually started as a really attacking batter and more of a Dwayne Bravo type player, if we're being honest. And Dwayne Bravo, like 30 years before we even knew that Dwayne Bravo was going to be a thing, right? Like you kept looking through and there's so many outliers in that team and you're just like, I know they were really thinking about this. And, but there's no doubt that if you go into a tournament where your lead spinner, which is Tim May, takes 4 wickets, and your fast bowler takes 18 wickets and you're in Asia, you have to say that Craig McDermott had a fantastic one as well. But it's probably out of those two for me.
That's fair. And I did not know about that about Steve Waugh. So that's news to me. Quite interesting as well, because I've always thought of him as this grafter. And incidentally, you know, next up is 1999, Australia's second World Cup win, Steve Waugh's team. And they had a terrible start to that tournament. They lost to both New Zealand and Pakistan. They made it to the Super Sixes based on their good net run rate. And thereon, they did not look back. They gave proper nightmares to South Africans still to this day. And they also, gave a proper, proper humbling to Pakistan in the final as well. It was as Australia gets. But my question is, were they more scrappy in 1999 than they were in this World Cup that just ended?
Ooh, that's a really good question. They were in disarray kind of in both tournaments. There was, I think this tournament, they were together as a team. I think in 1999, there were real divisions. Shane Warne and Steve Waugh were in sort of open conflict because Steve Waugh had dropped Shane Warne in the West Indies. Not because of form, of course, but just because he didn't think his shoulder was back. But, Shane Warne's a bit like Michael Jordan, right? Never let the truth get in front of a good story. I was dropped. But they also, if you look at their team compared to this World Cup, so they only really make Alex Carey as a change. And you could say that was quite negligible by the end of the tournament. Yeah. Alex Carey might have made roughly as many runs as Josh Inglis would have.
And Mitch Marsh came at first drop once head was back. So that's it.
Yeah, but even that was just an injury thing, right? So, if you look at what they did in that World Cup, 99, they play Julian and Shane Lee. So they were trying all their young all-rounders. They actually made a big mistake probably with selection for that World Cup, that they went with Julian and Lee. They should have taken Ian Harvey, who was much more suited to English conditions, would go on to be a county legend, would have been a frontline bowler in English conditions the way he bowled, and I would argue was probably a better bat than either Julian or Shane Lee was, but they were both a little bit quicker, I think, perhaps. And Shane Lee could have been a Lance Klusener type player, but it never really went about. But they had these two all-rounders that didn't really work early on. But then they had the incredible thing of Adam Dale. Do you remember Adam Dale? You weren't old enough in 99, maybe.
I was 5 in 99.
So Adam Dale.
I just remember everyone swearing at the TV in the final.
Sure. Yeah, certainly in the final. So Adam Dale was really interesting because Adam Dale was a really skillful bowler, but God, who would you even compare him to? He's almost like a Vernon Philander type bowler. I don't even know if that's even fair. You know, maybe Muhammad Abbas type of bowler. And
did Healy stand up to the stumps when he bowled?
Occasionally the keeper would come up. Yeah, not all the time, but it certainly had happened for Adam Dale. But it was that point where teams were really, really fixated on having very accurate opening bowlers because this is the first time we had people slamming runs at the top, right? So you couldn't just have you couldn't have Craig McDermott coming in spraying the ball around because the opposite, you know, Santos Jayasuriya or Gilchrist or Sachin or whoever was opening the batting was going to be, Syed Anwar slashing the ball over point, right? You know, all those sorts of players were existing. So teams were going with accurate bowlers. And the reason that Australia had Adam Dale as their opening bowler was so that Glenn McGrath could bowl first change. And Alan Donald had done that for South Africa and Australia copied that. It's really weird thinking back because Glenn McGrath is a seam bowler who is accurate and Alan Donald is a swing bowler who is slightly less accurate. So there was no reason to do that. It worked perfectly for South Africa. So you had a bunch of all-rounders who just probably were not good enough in World Cups with all due respect to Shane Lee and Brendan Julian. And then you had this huge problem where you took Glenn McGrath away from the new ball and he looked lost. It looked like, the emperor suddenly realizing he's got no clothes on, right? Like it was that drastic. And then on top of that, there was clearly Warne just lost all of his confidence, which sounds hilarious when you look at the rest of that tournament, right? But Warne lost his confidence and Steve Waugh was having issues with the team. So they were falling apart and it was kind of a combination of Glenn McGrath getting the ball back. I think the first game he got the ball back, he absolutely went ballistic again. And then Tom Moody came in was another really, really important thing. So again, when I was talking about Ian Harvey, Tom Moody and Ian Harvey are probably the two guys they should have taken over for that tournament, or even Andrew Symonds might have been quite handy as well, just because those guys were just much more suited to being all-rounders in English conditions. And Moody, I think he ends up playing about four games. Yeah, seven games, but he only batted 5 times. But he made 117 runs off 90 balls, was out once with a strike rate of 130. And with the ball, he went at 4.3 runs and over while taking a wicket in every game. So, you know, it just completely changed that team, dramatically. But it was Bevan and Waugh, really, and a little bit of Ponting coming good that sort of helped them in those games against South Africa. I think it was Bevan and Waugh the first time and Ponting and Waugh the second time. And then of course, the Shane Warne impact in the semi-final and the final is just, absolutely massive. Someone who had – it's weird to ever think of him not having confidence, but you got to remember that no one even knew if he'd ever come back from that shoulder injury. It was so bad. It was the second bad injury of his career after that finger as well. And he ends up as the leading wicket taker in the tournament, right? From nowhere. But they also got a very good tournament out of Damien Fleming, who's not remembered as good a cricketer as he should be, but he was fantastic in that tournament as well. But Steve Waugh again, this time Steve Waugh made 398 runs. And if you look at their batters, they were quite defensive. So Tom Moody striking quite well definitely helped them. But it was hard to get through their batters. There was a lot of good batting all the way down the order there. So it was scrappier, I would say, than this current World Cup. And also the other difference is that they didn't have World Cup winners in that team. Outside of Steve Waugh would have been the only one from 87, right?
Moody. So, Tom Moody was there in 87.
Did he play in the World Cup final?
Probably not. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, Moody was really experienced. But what I mean is, if it's weird to think back now that that Australian team had already taken over Test cricket, but they'd lost in 96. They'd been abject. They should have won in 92. 92, they arguably, well, they should have won in 92. It was at home, and they were terrible in that tournament. They, you know, them and Pakistan were fighting it for the fourth semi-final position. And it just, nothing worked. Like, they had Dean Jones and Dean Jones didn't work. And, you know, the top order didn't make any runs. The bowlers weren't particularly good. It all fell apart that particular tournament. 96, of course, is the one that could have gone their way, but Sri Lanka were just way more suited to the conditions and a better one-day team at that stage. 99, it's quite clear that Australia's getting good, but remember, South Africa's been the best team in that period. And so the part of the Warne McGrath legacy and what happens afterwards, most of the success the Australian team have is really between that 99 win and what happens certainly over the next 3 years. But if you go through to 2007, it's those 8 years altogether, right? That all comes from that particular victory. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's if Moody was in that other team, and you might be right, it was him and Steve Waugh, but they weren't like one-day legends at that stage. And I think a lot of us thought back home that they probably hadn't, like the strike rates were always an issue. We didn't think they were playing in the same way that others were. Like even Gilchrist in that tournament, doesn't do much, right? So in that tournament, Gilchrist made average 22, right? And Mark Waugh, who'd been maybe the player, one of the best players in the World Cup in 96, certainly maybe in the top five anyway, he makes 375 runs, an average of 41, which was absolutely fine, but that's nothing compared to what he does in 96, right? So they didn't get the runs from the top. Their middle order was fine, but that was not a juggernaut team. It's now tacked on to the 2003 and 2007 wins. But if the 2003 or 2007 team played the 99 team, they'd ask them to follow on.
Yeah, they would absolutely obliterate them, because I was old enough in 2003 and 2007. But going back to 99, of course, you know, it did start a cycle of excellence for Australia. Yep. They lost to Pakistan in the group stages, and then the next time they lost in a World Cup was in 2011, when once again they lost to Pakistan in the group stages. So that's a nice little Pakistan sandwich that they have, and three World Cups in between. But you mentioned a lot of players who had a good tournament, right? Mark Waugh wasn't as good as 96, but he still averaged 41 and scored tons of runs. Glenn McGrath, once he was back opening the bowling, he was wreaking havoc again and was at his devastating best or whatever. But there are two players that stand out over here. Steve Waugh, obviously he's the captain and he scores the bulk of Australia's runs, scores crucial runs, tough runs, big game runs. And then Shane Warne, you know, he's the player of the match in both the semi and the final. And whenever we think about 99, we almost always think about Shane Warne. So out of those two guys, who had the bigger impact?
I just want to check. I don't think Steve Waugh bowled all that much in that tournament.
And it's funny that you say that they were at loggerheads with each other, because they're the two names that kind of are competing with each other.
There was always an issue between them, because I think Shane Warne thought he should have been captain ahead of Steve Waugh, and they were very different the way they thought about cricket as well. The difference is that without Steve Waugh, Shane Warne doesn't play in a semi-final or a final. So you would have to argue that Steve Waugh had the bigger impact in the way that they, you know, in that particular tournament. But, you know, the end of Shane Warne's tournament was just so monumental. So, you know, they were going to lose that game against South Africa when he comes into that attack. He changes that game. He turns it into a scrap. And Steve Waugh had done a very similar thing with two innings in a row as well. Also, the 99 World Cup had one of the weirdest innings of all time, where Michael Bevan and Steve Waugh purposely batted as slow as possible to try and bat New Zealand out of the tournament on net run rate. So they purposely batted slow so that I think West Indies would get through on net run rate and not New Zealand. It didn't matter. New Zealand, well, I think won their game really quickly anyway. No one ever talks about that. It was really, it was, you know, like a football team intentionally letting goals in to get rid of another team on goal differential. I'd have to have a look at the numbers, but so I would say that the strike rate of Steve Waugh and Michael Bevan, they probably batted a little bit quicker than it looks on their overall numbers, just because of those. But yeah, no, I think Steve Waugh is the difference in that particular. It just, you look at 96 and you look at 99, they were still playing Test cricket really, Australia. And even 2003, in some ways they still are, and we'll get to that in a moment. But it's not as fully developed, even compared to 87, weirdly enough. Huh. It's not as fully developed as one day cricket. They still thought, we pick the best players and the best players will make it work. And it's really probably, you know, 2007 when they get to a point where they start to change that up a little bit.
As a cricket fan, you know the most important time of the year is here, when the Southern Hemisphere aligns with so much cricket. So if you're busy watching all the cricket you can, let me suggest Factor, a ready-to-eat meal delivery service that can help you with breakfast, the only really important meal, but also lunch and dinner if you need that, with chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. 35-plus weekly, flavor-packed, fresh, never frozen meals that support a healthy lifestyle and meet your meal preferences, all delivered right to your door and ready to eat in 2 minutes. Eat breakfast items like their delicious apple cinnamon pancake, bacon and cheddar egg bites, and potato bacon and egg breakfast skillet. These people will send bacon and eggs to your home while you watch cricket. This is the dream, people. So if you're looking for meals at home these holidays while you prepare for the most important day of the year, Boxing Day, head to factormeals.com/Inca50 and use the code Inca50 to get 50% off. That's code Inca50 at factormeals.com/Inca50 to get 50% off. Half price Boxing Day meal. Stuff them in your mouth without missing a single ball.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to 2003 and 2007. Then, of course, Australia were unbeaten and, well, undefeated in both of those. And 2003 is actually a tournament in which they were, you know, they were ran close by some of the teams. Pakistan had them on the ropes before Andrew Simons hit the knock of his life in Joburg. And then that England game, right? Andy Bickle, 7 for. And then England also getting wickets, but Michael Bevan kind of took them over the line. And he was obviously one of the more known finishers in the world, and still is.
People New talk Zealand about game?
Dhoni. Yeah, New Zealand game as well.
Yep.
And Bevan also had that reputation, like Dhoni of years after, right? That
he well, the finisher stay there tag, the, end. The finisher and chaser tag comes from Bevan, right? In the same way that I think the first time anchor was used was with Jeff Marsh, was certainly around that period. A slower ball bowler is first used with Steve Waugh and Simon O'Donnell, despite the fact that Franklin had bowled them slightly beforehand. So a lot of the terminology that we use in white ball cricket, I believe, does come from those Australian sides. So you're right, Bevan was that. And Bevan was phenomenal at that, right? Like it's really interesting going back because you've got a guy batting at number six, you know, who's averaging over 50 in ODI cricket, and no one in the top order averaging, and not just for Australia, no one in the world in the top order averaging over, and no one could get Bevan out. And he carried Australia to incredible victories again and again. And those two games that you're talking about, you know, the England one was him and Bickle together. And then I think it was him and Brett Lee in the, or certainly Brett Lee played a big part in the other one. You look at Bevan now and you look at what Dhoni was, but you also look at Kohli, you look at Shai Hope, you look at Babar Azam. A lot of what Bevan did is what the modern top order players now do, and that he did that from lower down the order and also was a failure in Test cricket, right? Incredible first-class player, never translated to Test cricket. And in one-day cricket, he just worked out the formula and just in a way that no one ever had before. He's the only player before the year 2000 to average over 50.
Yeah, that is phenomenal, or actually beyond phenomenal. And so those innings come to mind, you know, Simons and Joburg, and then Bevan versus England, and I think it was New Zealand, I can't quite recall. And New Zealand, you know, Shane Bond was at his best at that time, I'd say. He's never bowled better than that. So Australia, even though when you look at, you know, the results and everything, you're like, oh, they won every game. It wasn't quite like 2007. You know, there were a few games in which they could have lost, but they stuck it out. And the fact that Australia did not even have Jason Gillespie and Shane Warne in this World Cup, and yet they had assembled one of the best bowling attacks at that time. I mean, how? How is my only question.
It's incredible to think back on it. So the Indian team of this World Cup was going close to 2003 numbers, but they were still up. Big step back. And as you said, I think Gillespie plays two games, am I right? Yeah, does he not
I think at the start.
Yeah, oh, sorry, no, played four games. So this is his record of four games. This is mind-blowing. Because as you said, they've already lost Warne bowled some incredible spells in 96. In 99, semi-final and the final, ends up with the most wickets. They've already lost him. And then Gillespie, four games, he had 8 wickets at 12.
Yeah.
Right? And he is replaced by, I think Andy Bickle plays the rest of that tournament. I'm trying to think if they used any other seamers.
I believe so.
No, they didn't use any other seamers. Yeah. And so he Andy Bickle comes in. He plays 8 games, takes 16 wickets at 12. Now,
that's ridiculous.
If it's Gillespie, you're like, well, that's fair enough, right? Like, Gillespie was certainly in Australian great, maybe just below that all-time great level. Gillespie was very, very similar to Pat Cummins in the ability to bowl very, very accurately at high pace and just get little bits of movement. Andy Bickle was a fantastic player, don't get me wrong, but he played 19 tests and averaged 32, played 67 ODIs and averaged 31. And yet in that World Cup, he averages 12, right? And I think that the game against England, did he take a 6-for or a 7-for?
7-for.
Yeah, like just ridiculous. Also went at 3.45. McGrath in that tournament plays all 11 games. He bowls 18 maidens. And I just like, so more than a maiden a game and almost 2 maidens a game. Takes 21 wickets at 14. But here's the kicker. He went at 3.5 runs and over. Right.
Wow.
And some of those wickets were against Namibia, right? Where he takes 7 for 15, right? Mm. But that economy was against all teams, right?
True.
And Brett Lee, he takes 22 wickets. So he actually takes more wickets than McGrath. His record of striking in World Cups is not far behind Shami's, by the way. Just didn't play as many World Cups as Shami, I think I'm right in saying that. Or maybe didn't play as many games or didn't take as many wickets altogether. But
yeah,
he's got an average of 18. Because Brett Lee was the one just behind Shami on when I was first looking at it. And then Ian Harvey comes in as a replacement. So I think it is when, because does Simons play all the games? No, Simons doesn't play all the games. And Martin misses a couple. And so they bring Ian Harvey in. As I said, should have played in 1999, probably at that stage. But he comes in, your fifth bowling option, and he takes 8 wickets at 19 at 4.3 runs and over. And again, he bowled in the death, some of that. I remember he bowled the last over to Sri Lanka in one of the games. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, is that right? No, he certainly bowled at the death. Might not have bowled the last over. But he was certainly involved at the death, I think, at times. And so those are the, you know, you've got Harvey, Bickle as your replacements, and they've been absolutely incredible. But we haven't got to Brad Hogg, who on the other podcast, was it which podcast? You on another podcast, you just said Brad Hogg was shit. But let me just tell you what Brad
Hogg. I said that Zampa is better than Brad Hogg. Okay, don't twist my words.
I must have misheard. Brad Hogg, bowling in South Africa, remember? He bowls almost 80 overs in the tournament, takes 13 wickets at 25 with an economy of 4.25, right? Mm. Again, Brad Hogg wasn't supposed to be playing in that World Cup. Ian Harvey really wasn't supposed to be a frontline player in that World Cup. And Andy Bickle was certainly not supposed to be playing. And yet these guys are all averaging under 25 and going for no runs, right?
Yeah.
It was remarkable. So what would they have done with a fully fit Gillespie and Shane Warne? They were and this is the one thing I suppose with Harvey, he was more of a one-day cricketer, although I still think Harvey would have been a fine test cricketer if they needed an all-rounder in that era. Or you could have batted Harvey at 7 and batted Gilchrist at 6, but they never needed to do that or never wanted to do that. But they certainly could have done that. But that's still pretty much a test attack. And I think they did lean in a little bit. And if you look at that 2003, yes, their batters made a lot of runs, and some of them, Gilchrist was more than a run a ball in that tournament, but they weren't fully off the chain with the bat. They were making lowish totals, again, a bit like 99, but that bowling lineup was so good that it just didn't matter, man.
That's true. And I mean, that's the crazy part in all of this, right? Because they didn't have Gillespie, they didn't have Warne, yet you look at the replacements, look at their numbers. And I mean, quick question to you before we move on to 2007 or something. Is that World Cup, 2003, the best that Binger and Pidge have bowled in tandem in ODI cricket? Because you could just not chase 200 against that team.
I just want to look, what was 2007 like? 2000 and, I know I've gone to 2007.
2007 had Sean Tate, Nathan Bracken, McGrath was obviously there.
No, Lee was injured, wasn't he? Missed that one.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, no, then it would have to have been probably when they're at their best. So I backpacked to that tournament. So it's quite an important one for me as a human in many different ways. You know, my first time outside the country, you know, backpacking around South Africa. We'd already backpacked around America and England before we got there. And my memory of those games was when we were batting, we were just really nervous. Me and my mate out in the stands, we didn't sit with the other Aussies all that much, but if there are other Aussies around, the minute we got past 200, we were like, oh, well, this is fine. And I don't think, even in like 1975 and 1979, 1983, if you get over 200, you're around par, right? Like, it's not like, I think there are some people who think in the old days, 180 was par in one day cricket. It wasn't, right? Like, you still had to score 220, 230 to feel comfortable. Australia got past 200 in 2003, and you're like, well, this is over. The other team will not be able to do it. And, you know, India in the final actually batted really well and still realistically didn't get all that close, right? And that was probably the best all-round batting performance. What did Pakistan make? Do you remember?
Not much. They didn't come close to the 310 or 11 target.
Yeah. So, I thought maybe Sri Lanka batted well in, I can't remember if it was the semi-final or the Super 6 game or whenever it was. But I thought there was one game when maybe Sri Lanka looked like they could make more runs or whatever that may be. But the point being that they got over 200 and we were like, this is done. And it's just a ridiculous, and I'm not saying like they got 280 and it was done. Like, we were thinking 205 is enough, 203 is enough. And I don't think we've ever seen a team like that. And as I said, I thought India in this World Cup might have been pushing towards that. But in the end, you know, New Zealand did score a lot of runs against them, and Australia chased down 230 quite easy. So realistically, this might be the best bowling team we've ever had at a World Cup.
Man, you have to say that, I think. And you're right to point out that India is probably the closest team that could come to that sort of 2003 Australian team, because that's bowling out of hell, right? And quick question for you. Punter's 100 in the 2003 final in the Wanderers, or Gilchrist's 100 in 2007 versus Sri Lanka? Which ton was better, and why do they both do not stand up or are even close to Travis Head's 100 versus India in this final?
I mean, I thought that Indian bowling lineup of 2003 was incredible. And Ponting made them look silly. I think if he had played T20 cricket by that point, he would have made a double 100. Right? Like, he was so in control of what he was doing against a really, really good attack. I think Gilchrist's was more of a Gilchrist explosive innings, but I don't think it was as good as Ponting's was. And Head's is probably better considering the situation that the game was in and everything else. But Head wasn't in control the way that Ponting was in control. As I said, if the game was different, or if a young Ricky Ponting was such an explosive cricketer, and a bit like what we see with a lot of Indian batters, this used to always happen with Australian batters, and Andrew Symons is a perfect example. Andrew Symons' strike rate in that tournament is 90. His strike rate should be 150. In that tournament and in every tournament he played in, really. I think with Ponting, like, he's ended up with a strike rate of 80 in ODI cricket. He should have scored at a run of ball. And that particular game, he was just so in control of everything he did. It, from a technical standpoint, I haven't seen many better hundreds in that kind of pressure type situation.
So are we going Ponting, then Head, and then Gilly?
Yeah, that's very unfair on Mike Valletta, but sure.
Yeah, I mean, Travis Head, I think, look, the only thing with Gilchrist is that he was hitting Dilhara Fernando. That's where I have issues, right?
Yeah.
And both Punter and Travis Head, they were up against some really quality attacks.
If you're looking at quality of attacks, Head probably has the highest one. Mm-hmm. But Ponting's was not far behind that. That was a really, really good bowling attack as well. And Ponting had a better batting wicket because, you know, Sehwag still made runs as well. And all the Australians made runs, right? There was 100-run opening partnership. And then, is that right? I think that's what it was. I think it was a decent opening partnership anyway. And then Martin made runs as well. Martin had a broken hand in that, broken fingers, I think, in that World Cup final as well. After the game, we were on the same plane as the team and he couldn't shake anyone's hand. His hand was so like mangled up. So that was, you know, a remarkable innings as well. And it's weird to look back at that team because, where are we? 2003, wasn't it? You had Simons, Martin, Ponting, Bevan, Lehman, Gilchrist, Hayden, and it was a bowling World Cup for them.
Yeah, that's quite remarkable.
Oh, Brad Hogg and Ian Harvey as well. So like the batting went all the way down in some of those games, and yet still.
Yet still it was a bowling World Cup, yeah. And I mean, they scored, what, 350, 360 in the final? That's like 450 of today.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That final, if you replayed that today with the current knowledge, those players would have just gone absolutely nuts. I remember feeling even at the time like Ponting was chipping it around, and yet they were scoring at that rate. It was a masterclass. It's, from a technical point of view, I haven't seen many better innings than that one.
Not the last time Punter scored runs at the Wanderers. Of course, the next time he lost a game after having scored 430-odd. So there's a fun fact for you guys. But anyway, in 2007, Australia were as good with the bat as they were with the ball. Haydos was the leading run scorer, and him and Punter were scoring runs for fun, really. And Glenn McGrath had arguably his best ever World Cup, 26 wickets, and no one could play him. And, you know, that was one World Cup where I felt, and I was like, what, a teenager at that point, there was never any doubt that Australia will not lift that trophy. Like, it was just kind of set in stone, written in the stars that, yes, whoever finishes second, it's as good as a trophy at this point. Because that's just how dominant they were.
Yeah. I mean, India, this tournament, right? Like, we didn't... It was very hard to see a way that they would not win. I remember Shane Watson, I think, starts batting at number 7. And they ended up just putting him up the order because of the way he was batting in that tournament. He makes 145 runs off 85 balls in that tournament.
It's ridiculous.
And that's like a Klusner-like impact. Mm-hmm. And it meant that, so Brad Hodge played 5 games as a specialist batter and batted in 2 of them, right? Like, it was just remarkable. I think Mike Hussey's the other one. Yeah, Mike Hussey actually had a terrible tournament, by the way, despite the fact that I think he was averaging 50 going into that tournament. Mike Hussey only batted in half the games he played as well, right? Like, it was just, they were so dominant, their batters. And I think their bowlers were good. I don't think they were quite at 2003 level, although it could just be that the pitchers didn't, you know, West Indian pitchers maybe didn't help the bowlers as much. But they were just absolutely dominant. So Hayden, I'm just trying to get up his numbers. Hayden scored 659 runs from 652 balls, an average of 73. Ponting averages 67. Simon averages 63. Clark averages 87. Watson averages 145. Brad Hodge in 2 innings averages 76, right? Gilchrist failed. Only averaged 45 at more than a run a ball in that tournament. So they had 1, 2, 3, 4 batters at better than a run a ball in their top order. Also, Brad Hogg made 45 runs from 21 ball. He smashed a 40 against someone. I can't remember who that was now. But so he had a strike rate of 200. So that was probably how they expected their batting to be in 2003. And I think 2007 is almost the perfection of that batting. At that stage, they've kind of got rid of the sort of that Lehman type of player, which they'd had before, which is almost like the Steve Waugh player of 99, of that experienced kind of player. And, you know, if they've got Watson, Clark, who are both younger, and then they've got Mike Hussey playing the Bevan role. Andrew Simons is now a proper batter, which he wasn't. He was only a proper batter in 2003 because of the Pakistan innings. He wasn't originally, and even then, as I said, there was always a thing of who do you play, him or Harvey, or do you play both of them? They weren't even sure 100% of how to go about it. And by the time they get to this tournament, they're just like, it's just a machine, right? And everything works. And we've only talked about the batting. The bowling's quite good too.
Yeah. Sean Tate had a good World Cup. Nathan Bracken had a good World Cup. Of course, McGrath had a goated World Cup. But
what was Brad Hogg's record in that World Cup, Bayram? Because you said that Zampa was better than him in a previous podcast. Do you want me to read his figures?
Go for it.
11 games, 82.5 overs, 21 wickets at 15.8.
Holy crap.
I mean, you know, and he doesn't have the best figures on the team because... Glenn McGrath takes 26 wickets at 13, right? Yeah.
And that I remember.
Who's the other star bowler who was the number one ODI bowler in the world? And I reckon
Stuart Clarke.
No.
Wasn't it? Oh.
Well, Stuart Clarke plays a game and also takes wickets and then never. Oh, well, sorry, I think went for no runs or something in his one game. No, there was another bowler who was the best ODI bowler in the world for a little period. And literally, sadly for him, never ended up with a T20 career. And sadly, is now forgotten. But for a couple of years, as good a bowler as anyone, and you don't even remember his name, which just shows you. And you mentioned Tate before.
Well, I mentioned Bracken as well, if you're talking about Bracken.
Did you mention Bracken?
I did take his name. That's why I was confused. Oh, I could never forget that hair. No one can ever forget that hair.
Do you want his figures?
Go for it.
10 maidens, a maiden a game, 16 wickets, at an average of 16. Economy 3.6. So McGrath went at 4.1, right? And then Tate, who you mentioned, 23 wickets at 20, went at 5.5 and over. And I think does Watto bowl a little bit? Yeah, Watto and Simons bowl a little bit. Watto is economical but doesn't take any wickets. So a little bit weaker in their fifth bowler, although I think Hodge bowled a little bit. So they were juggling that fifth bowler in a way that in that previous World Cup, they didn't, you know, they got away with it a lot more. Like if you look at that 2003 World Cup, Harvey plays as the fifth bowler. Lehman bowled quite well in that tournament. And Simons was sort of their backup at times. So 2007, they have a better bowling tournament with a weaker fifth bowler. And it's just, a fantastic bowling tournament without a strong fifth bowler, I should say. And look, it was phenomenal. Like that, again, on paper, still not as strong as the team they should have taken into 2003, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and yet completely dominant. And you can see 99 and 87, well, all-rounders are their thing. By 2003 and 2007, you know, Harvey doesn't make it through to the final in 2003. Simons, we call him an all-rounder, but we all know he couldn't even decide whether he wanted to bowl pace or spin. Like the man did, he bowled whatever he had to. And by 2007, he's bowling a little bit, Clark's bowling a little bit, Watto's bowling a little bit, and Hodge is bowling a little bit. There's no clear all-rounder in that lineup either. So they've completely changed their method when it comes to their teams from that earlier template, and yet become better because essentially McGrath just gives you the best start of all time of any bowler ever. And so they start every game with the chance of getting two or three wickets. And whether it be Fleming, Rifle, Dale, Bickle, Gillespie, Bracken, who else we got? Stuart Clarke, Sean Tate, someone else chips in with wickets early on. And so every game you were losing a lot of wickets. And the only other team we've seen being able to do that consistently over a long period of time was Pakistan, right? Mm. And Pakistan never had this batting, right? They couldn't back it up with that level of bat. Pakistan's batting was never terrible, but it was never like, you know, it was never
elite.
It was never six blokes averaging over 60, was it? Like, I should say that 2007 World Cup is the best batting any team's ever had in a World Cup. They average, I think, something like 67 runs per wicket. So India at their best in this World Cup, which was before the final, I'm right in saying before the final, was averaging 55, right? Mm. So if you think India's batting was good in this World Cup, they were 12 runs a wicket worse before the final.
Yeah. I mean, I vividly remember the 2007 World Cup first because Pakistan got knocked out by Ireland, but also, you know, this was that first World Cup for me where I was not just a young kid who was obsessed with cricket, but I was a nerd at this point, right? I knew things. I watched every game. Yeah. I watched every game and I cannot remember a single game where Australia were challenged. Yeah. It was like India's 2023 World Cup, only Australia went on to win it, you know? And it's as dominant as I've ever seen any team play probably any World Cup. Across sport, that's how good they were.
Oh, across sport, I like that. I mean, to be fair, America and basketball have had some pretty good tournaments. But
are we really counting the basketball World Cup then?
Basketball has been played for over 100 years. Other teams have had a chance to catch up with them, if we're being fair. Although, had Yugoslavia not split, but that's a whole different conversation. Look, I think you're right. you know, I don't want to get into whether the All Blacks have had a greater tournament or whatever it may be for other sports. But from a cricket perspective, through in this World Cup, if you've been following the scoreboard, or actually probably the main videos we've been talking about it more, this is the team I've been comparing India to the most.
Yeah.
So 2003 was just a slightly different kind of team. And even though 2003 was, you could put an argument that both teams were not that far off each other. The fact that the Australian team couldn't out-bat teams as much in 2003 meant that they were relying on one side of the ball. And you know how I feel about that with our many chats about Pakistan over the years. whereas in 2007, there is the only weakness is that fifth bowler. And because they have four guys who they can go to, which is very similar to this time, but also it's stronger, right? Because if you look at those four guys, Michael Clarke was a decent, you know, spinner, you know, in limited overs cricket until his back went through. So what are we looking at with his bowling in ODI cricket? Averages 37, it goes at less than five runs and over. I would say he's probably, all things considered, a better ODI spinner than Maxwell, for instance. Shane Watson, certainly a better bowler than Mitchell Marsh or Stoinis. Even if he wasn't the Shane Watson that he could have been at that stage, he was already not quite at his best. Andrew Symonds, still more than handy. And even someone like Brad Hodge can bowl, right? And then, you know, you've got a little bit of all-rounderness in the batting with the ability to have Brad Hogg down the order. It didn't matter because no one ever got to them. So I would just wonder, this would be really interesting to compare India. So 2007 World Cup final, right? I'd be really interested to see what Australia's number eight was listed as in that game. So, okay, so it was Hogg. So still a lot stronger than India. So they then Mohammad Shami or Bumrah or whoever was going to come out there. So the weakness is really that fifth bowler, but because you have Watson who can bowl probably still 85-ish, which was a good pace back then. And then you have the three other guys with their three different kinds of skill sets. You're probably in a better position than, say, New Zealand or Australia were in this particular World Cup. But it doesn't matter if your opening bowler is averaging 13 and your spinner is averaging 14, right? Like you or I could have been their fifth bowler and they probably still win.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember as a young Pakistan fan, I was just hoping that they play a final. Of course, they crapped all over my dreams very, very early in the tournament. But that was literally my hope, that I would love to see Pakistan, you know, come back home
in the final to Australia.
Yeah, and that's what Jayawardene also said after the final, that look, Australia operated at a different level. Yep. We're very, very happy with where we finished. Anyway, let's go to 2015 now, right? Mm-hmm. Home World Cup for the Aussies, and their only defeat came in that New Zealand game in which Trent Bolt just went crazy.
It was
a proper bowl-off between Trent Bolt and Mitchell Starc in that game, I remember. And Pakistan gave them a bit of a scare in the quarterfinals, but apart from that game and obviously the loss to New Zealand, again, it was a fairly dominant performance by the Aussies. And in the semi-final and final, they beat a great Indian team comprehensively. Then in the final, they beat the best ever, arguably the best ever ODI team that New Zealand have ever assembled, especially in terms of the brand of cricket that they played with, going hard at the top. And I mean, where would you rank that particular World Cup win, 2015, amongst all six?
Well, this is the weird thing of, like, if you ask me to rank them, 87 is the most important, but clearly 2007, they were the best. So how do you rank the most important compared to the most dominant? And so,
let's say more complete teams then.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're doing more complete, because of Faulkner in that tournament, I would have thought that they didn't have a weak bowler. So Mitchell Marsh bowls 13 overs, Clarke bowls 5 overs. Maxwell still bowls 38 overs, so they're still cheating. So Faulkner's sort of playing as the fourth bowler, then more a little bit for the majority of that tournament. I mean, that's, you know, do you know what Starc's bowling average is for that tournament, by the way?
I just remember that I would often get afraid just looking at Mitch Starc from the TV set. That's how good he was.
It's the same as Shami's in this tournament.
That makes sense. Yeah. Because when you think of 2015, the first face that comes into your mind is Mitch Starc. And the one image that comes to mind, like a video clip of sorts, is him cleaning up a red-hot Brendan McCullum in the final.
So I'll tell you a story about that. This is one of my greatest moments. Mm. We were all in the MTG press box was quite small. It's ridiculously small. And I've never understood why a ground that big has a press box is small. And we were in the overflow area. I can't remember even where we were. But I remember it was me and Will McPherson, and I can't remember who the third person was. And the game was about to start, and MCG was just humming. And like, I've been going to that ground since I could walk, right? Like, never seen it like that before. Not even, and I've been to, you know, two or three AFL grand finals. I've been to, you know, huge events, rugby events, and Boxing Day tests. I've never seen the MCG like that before. And I said to McPherson, we have to go watch this outside. We have to watch the first over outside. And that happened. Yeah. And it was like the whole place exploded. I've never seen anything like it. The biggest problem was from a cricket journalist point of view and from a neutral fan point of view, that was it. It felt like the game was over, like an over in, right? But that for that moment, it was kind of worth it if you were in the ground. It's funny, me and Martin Nicholas had a chat a while back, and we both said it was the best moment we've ever seen in that ground. And, you know, he's obviously gone to a lot of games as well. And I've seen some incredible football games, that have come down, you know, a Tyne football games and all sorts of things. But he was just incredible in that tournament. And he was a big part of it. Cummins only plays two games in that tournament.
Yeah.
So they could have been better. Hmm. People forget how good Faulkner was.
Yeah.
We were going to do a video. Yeah, we were going to do a video for this World Cup, which I never quite got around to, which was, you know, one of the great forgotten World Cups is what James Faulkner had in that, because he only plays six games. He takes 10 wickets. He's incredible in the final. Wasn't even needed with the bat. People have forgotten how good a cricketer James Faulkner was for about 2.5 years, right? And
do you remember that 100 that he scored in India?
Yeah, exactly. And then by the end of his career, I was writing about him being maybe the biggest blocking artist in T20 cricket, and he could barely bowl. His knees just went, and, you know, it's a real shame. Anyway, he was fantastic in that tournament, but they didn't even use him in all the games. Mitchell Johnson didn't have a particularly great tournament, like from the way we talk about it, and he averaged 21, right? So they had Hazelwood, Johnson, Faulkner, Cummins, Stark.
Wow.
Right? So the spinner is clearly an issue. I think, does X-Man play? Yeah, so Xavier plays one game, Xavier Doherty. Mm. Maxwell ends up being the frontline spinner in Australia, which they got away with. Shane Watson barely bowls in that tournament and got hammered. That's part of the reason he didn't bowl. As I said before, I think Mitch Marsh and Michael Clarke bowled, barely. But I think Clark's back was gone by then.
It was gone.
Yeah, Mitch Marsh didn't do particularly well. But yeah, it's a weird World Cup. I almost feel like the top four teams were very similar in that if you told me that India, Australia, South Africa or New Zealand won that tournament, you know, maybe New Zealand and Australia were slightly better than the other two. I think Australia had a gear with their batting. I remember Dhoni sort of saying that in the semi-final of they just made too many runs and we couldn't make that amount of runs against them. And maybe that's true. So Maxwell averages 65 with a strike rate of 182 in that tournament. Warner averaged 50 with a strike rate of 120. Haddon didn't bat that much but averaged 42 with a strike rate of 157. Watto, 40, a strike rate of 106. Smith averaged 67 and a strike rate of 91. And Michael Clarke, I think, had quite a good strike rate for him as well. Again, like there's a lot of guys there. What they didn't have was maybe as many players with massive run totals. But, you know, Smith, 402, Maxwell, 324, Warner, 345. And then you've got Watto, Clarke and Finch all made over 200. I think Finch made a big 100 early on and then didn't do anything else. Faulkner's batting, which should have been a plus, wasn't needed in that particular tournament, right? Cummins not being fit all the way through that tournament didn't matter either. You're seeing a team that a bit like India and Hardik Pandya, a bit like Pakistan without Waqar Yunus in 92. you know, mm-hmm. these teams without their best players still being absolutely fantastic. I don't know how to rank it. And I don't know if you're going to ask me to try and rank the six at the end, but I don't know how to rank this one.
I did not have that in my itinerary, but I mean, if you feel like it, go for it.
I don't feel like it, but I kind of feel like this should be sixth, right? Hmm. But there's nothing wrong with it, right?
Yeah.
It's just that 87 is so special. 2023 is now going to be quite special. The three in a row are all incredible in different ways.
Yeah.
The 2015 almost feels like I think sometimes even when I count them, I'm like, I have to remember that one happened. Mm-hmm. And 87, I feel like that just because it was from a different lifetime, but not for any other reason. Did we mention Hazelwood played? Yeah, Hazelwood played as well.
Yeah, he did.
He averaged 25 with the ball. Of course he did. I feel like it's the least special one. But it's certainly not the worst side they had. Like you might go back to 99, if we're being honest, to say what their worst side was in a World Cup win. You might even argue it's this 2023 one. 87 looks like a bad side on paper then, but Steve Waugh would go on to be a legend, right? Craig McDermott was a really important player. We know how good Bruce Reid was now. Dean Jones would revolutionize the way that teams played. You know, Simon O'Donnell was a really important player at that. So at the time, it probably didn't look like a good team. This team is fantastic, and I don't know where to go, but I think it's the sixth. If we're doing most important, I think this is the sixth least important of the wins overall.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And at that time, it was just like, oh, Australia have won another one?
Yeah, exactly.
Seriously? And the whole world was with New Zealand, right? Other than the Aussies. Everyone wanted McCullum to lift that trophy. And they were that great feel-good story. Even, I remember the late Martin Crowe, he really wanted New Zealand to win that one.
Yeah, so I was friends with Martin, obviously. And at that stage, we were hanging out. And I saw him after that final. In fact, it was the last time I saw him alive. And he waited around to film with us. With two men out, me and Andy Zaltzman. So you can have a look. The footage is still up there. It's incredible. And he's having an argument with the Fred Spofforth doll that Andy Zaltzman made. Mm-hmm. Well, Andy Zaltzman's sister made, actually, for being honest. I think it was his sister. But he was heartbroken. And I remember he gave me this big hug. I mean, now thinking back on it, he probably knew that was the last time he was going to see me as well. But he was just broken. You just saw it in his eyes because... Mm-hmm. You know, he'd never quite gotten over 92, and there was that feeling that he just knew he was never going to. He might have even said that. I can't remember now. It was quite late on a big day for me. It was huge. And I remember I wrote the big piece about New Zealand anyway. Crick Info were not happy because Australia won the World Cup, and I was like, then it's not the story here. New Zealand is the story here. It's one of the best pieces I've ever written. Like, it just came out exactly as I wanted it to come out, and it flowed and everything. And that was their World Cup, New Zealand, and Australia won it. And I'm not saying that New Zealand was better because, as I said, I think all four of the top teams were fairly similar. Maybe Australia and New Zealand just had a bit more power and maybe slightly better bowling altogether. But I didn't think there was that much between all those top four sides. And it seems when there's a power gap, Australia just win, right?
Yeah. I mean, Usman Samiuddin just wrote about it, right? That in 1999, Pakistan brought out their best ever ODI side. Australia defeated them comprehensively. 2003, 2023, you know, two great Indian sides. In 23, arguably the best ever Indian ODI side ever assembled. Australia beat them comprehensively both occasions. Sri Lanka 2007, world-class side, not a problem for Australia. And New Zealand 2015, you know, it doesn't get better than that. Yet Australia just easily overcame them.
Well, 1999, the interesting thing about 99 is that South Africa were the best team in the world. And if they weren't, Pakistan were the best team in the world. And by the end, everyone thought Australia was the best team in the world again.
Yeah.
And you know, even now, it'd be really interesting to see how this one is seen because people don't talk about the fact that New Zealand should have won in 92. They talk about the upset in 83, but they still, you know, West Indies aren't seen as this dominant force. It'd be really interesting to see how this goes up because, you know, 2023, I think the two most dominant sides, I'm not quite including the early West Indies sides just because this is not to slate them, just because one day cricket wasn't at that level. But I would say the three best sides I've ever seen in World Cups would be the 2003 Australians, the 2007 Australians, and the 2023 Indians. And Australia's beaten them. So what the fuck do you do? Do you know what I mean? What the fuck do you do with that information, right?
Like, it does not make sense at all. And of course, we'll finally come to 2023 now. And Australia, you know, they had no business stealing this World Cup from underneath India's noses. This was India's cup. It was all prepared that way as well. And this was going to be this big festival of cricket and celebration of Indian cricket by the end of it. And Australia completely, you know, shat all over those plans. And come to think of it, you know, that Maxwell 200 versus Afghanistan. I think after that, maybe, you know, Australia sat down with each other and they were like, okay, we're going to win this now. Because that was one of those games in which, you know, they were 91 for 7. They had to score 200 more runs. Then Maxwell did what Maxwell did. Cummins was there at the other end. And you've got some great individual performances. Head in the final, head in the semi-final. Zampa was consistent throughout. The seamers came up trumps in the knockout stages as well, even though they were not having a good World Cup before that. And Australia had constant struggles in the middle order. Mm. They had a non-existent middle order, really. And everything just fell into place come semi-final and final. And that is as Australia as things can possibly get in a World Cup.
Yeah, and this is the thing that me and some other people in Australian cricket are most frustrated about, which is they didn't really prepare properly. They were panicking after two games. You know, they contacted...
It was one of the weaker sides that Australia has won a World Cup with.
Oh, without doubt. I mean, it's not weak on paper, I think, other than maybe the Inglis Marnus section. But it's certainly on form. And on where all those players were at this point in their careers and everything else, you'd be hard to
ages. Argue. They're all old.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah, all those sorts of things. Mm. But I mean, they contacted me after two games, basically going, "We don't know what we're doing, right?" Mm. And we are sitting here, and they have not. They did not lose a lot of the game after they talked to me. So clearly, I'm no. But the point being is that's where they were. Right? They were panicking.
They've also thrown a lot of shade at people who had written them off.
They wrote them
new. This is very basketball-y, isn't it? A bit of LeBron James over there.
Mate, they wrote themselves off, right? They didn't know what they were doing. And you know, this is the frustration, as I said, for people like me. We want the Australian cricket team, and you can make the same thing of Pakistan. We want it to be, it's okay if they do try everything they can and they fail because the other team's better. Or the other team gets the better of the conditions, or they play a good game and it's close and they lose, right?
Yeah.
The issue is that Australia and Pakistan are so convinced in their own almighty talent and that they'll come to this World Cup and it will just magically come together. And to be fair to Australia, it has happened a lot, right? Mm. And some of these tournaments they did prepare quite well for. Some of them they did not, right? Certainly they have not for 2023. They probably spent less time preparing for 2023 than they did for 87, which is hilarious thinking back. But the point being is that it's a frustrating thing, and eventually India and Pakistan and Bangladesh, these places with much higher interest in cricket, with that are making more and more money off their cricket all the time, that have vastly bigger populations, will work it out. And the funny thing is that this is the World Cup where you kind of expected that. This is the first World Cup that should have been the first step in India's domination over the next 20 years, right?
Yeah.
They're the best team in all three formats in some, or maybe not quite T20, but certainly the best. They're in the top two in all three formats. So they're best all-format team, I would say.
Yeah.
They were at home. They had the best of conditions. They had the best of the form, right? Mm-hmm. They were playing on a wicket that probably suited them more than Australia. I think, you know, even if they didn't get the toss quite in their favour, overall, it's certainly a pitch that suited them more than it would the Australian team.
They had the crowd advantage.
They had the massive crowd advantage. They hadn't lost a game all tournament. And yet Australia finds a way. And, you know, if you look at 87, if you look at 99, if you look at 15 and you look at 2023, you take out the two glory years. It really is that Australia find a way. And the one thing I would say is they've had a lot of very good role players, right? So we talked about, you know, guys like Bickle and Valletta and Hogg and Simon O'Donnell and Tom Moody and all these sorts of guys. But you look at the Australian side, and the one reason I thought they had a chance, which is you might have read the piece where I talked about the four ways that Australia could win.
Yeah.
They still had a lot of match winners. And if you go back through the history of Australian cricket in ODIs, the role players quite often step up at the right time, but it's the match winners that they have, the ability to have, you know, Dean Jones and Steve Waugh and Andrew Simons and, you know, Adam Gilchrist and Matthew Hayden and Ricky Ponting and all these different players who are, when they go off, there is no one in the world who could stop them, right? Mm-hmm. And so you look at this World Cup, and there's Cummins, there's Hazelwood, there's Stark, there's Head, there's Warner, there's Marsh, there's Maxwell. And you're like, yes, this team is a bit of a Frankenstein's monster, and you wouldn't probably put it together like this, and you'd prefer it had a proper fifth bowler. You'd certainly prefer to get rid of one of Inglis, Smith and Marnus. Too many of the same kind of batters playing the same kind of roles. You wish that Cameron Green was a year and a half more experienced. All those things are true, right? But when it comes down to it, Australia always has match winners pretty much from 1987 to now, where they have multiple match winners in most World Cups. And even the World Cups at which they've lost, you know, so 92 and 86, you might put 2011 and 2019 also in similar categories. If they had won, it wouldn't have always been the most surprising thing in the world, because it would have been in 96, it probably would have been Shane Warne or Glenn McGrath who would have won it for them, right? You know, even in 2011, maybe it's a Mitchell Johnson spell or a Brett Lee. I think Brett Lee must have been in that World Cup, right? No, maybe he wasn't actually. But whoever it was.
Which one? 2011, he was. Brett Lee was there in 2011.
Yeah, it's a Brett Lee spell that gets you over the line, right? And in 2019, Mitchell Stark was incredible and dragged them into games they didn't deserve to be in. And there's always these players, and we've seen it with the IPL and everything else. There's still a lot of very, very top level players, like, you know, Maxwell and Cummins. I mean, Stark would be one of the highest paid players in the IPL ever if he put himself available for it consistently. Hazelwood's gone on to be a great player. Warner is an absolute rock in the IPL. Right, you know, Mitchell Marsh is, you know, might have a big few years. Travis Head's now going to be going over there as well, right? They have those match-winning players, and it's the combination of those two things. If you go back to when they were really successful in Test cricket, what I thought they undervalued was the fact that if you have a team that has Glenn McGrath and Shane Warne in it, you can paper over a lot of cracks. But the other thing that I thought they were always really good at was getting the most out of role-playing players. And it's that combination of knowing that you've got a player in your side like Josh Inglis, right, who didn't have any major impact in this World Cup, but in the semi-final, he probably made the runs that got them over the line, if we're being honest. Mm-hmm. And in the final, he takes five catches, right? Mm-hmm. Even their worst players, Andy Bickle, Mike Valletta, right? You go through that combination is different than any other team we've ever seen in World Cups. West Indies has had a lot of brilliant players, but quite often their role players just didn't have any impact, you know, outside of the odd Colas King innings. Their role players didn't have major impacts in World Cups. And a lot of teams are carrying players hoping their stars will take over. Australia has more stars, and then their role players do everything that they need to do. And it's a testament, I think, to the fact that they still, even though now Pakistan, India, Bangladesh should be dominating them, it's a testament to professionalism and structures and all the other stuff that they go in. But there's also, I think we just have to be honest, that they are still producing far too much talent for what is a little island, but a massive island, but with very few people on it, right?
The biggest island ever.
It's a very big island, let's be honest. But you know what I mean? There's no one living on it, right?
Yeah.
And
they're only living on the corners, right? There's no one in the middle.
Really, just it's the just East Coast, if we're being
coastal.
Honest. Australia is like, 75% three cities, right? So essentially, India was just beaten by, you know, Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane. We'll throw Perth in there just for fun as well, right? But it's ridiculous that we're in this situation. But there is something about Australian sporting culture and excellence and professionalism and the way that they think about sport as a job that I don't know if every other cricket culture does still, right? Mm-hmm. They were the first truly professional cricket nation. England obviously went way beyond them with professionalism, and BCCI giving it a fair run. But there is something there. But it's also got to be, let's be honest, the fact that they happen to peak at a period where they picked up three in the middle on the bounce, where maybe if they worked out one day cricket, or maybe if Herschel Gibbs takes that catch, right?
Who's to say?
I don't know. I don't know what is going to happen, but I can't explain how they've been this good for this long, because they're not as dominant a team as they used to be, and yet they have still won what, two of the last four? Is my math right?
Yeah, your math is right. Two of the last three, because 2019 is the only one they didn't.
They've won two of the last three, and at no stage at that point have we thought of them as the Australia of 99 to 2007. Like, it doesn't make sense. They won a T20 World Cup when they didn't. Again, they're in complete disarray. Like, I don't know what to do with this, Bayram. I can't analyze fucking nonsense.
That's true. I mean, they're not even close to those teams of 2003 and 2007, not even in the slightest. And this is not Australia's like peak in cricket. Like, we've already seen that. And it's crazy how, like you mentioned, you know, so many fucks are given about cricket in the subcontinent. It's like a second religion over here. And Australia just routinely managed to break those hearts over and over and over again, World Cup after World Cup after World Cup. And yeah, I mean, I think it makes perfect sense, the fact that you said that the professionalism and how Australia is a sporting nation and they treat, you know, sport like a job, that's got to play a part in this. And also, I would say that the fact that they find themselves in these positions every now and then so frequently, and the historical knowledge of them going over the line, I think it just kind of spurs them on and motivates them that, hey, we're Australia, we're going to go win this.
There's certainly a belief within Australian cricket that it's really weird. If you talk to New Zealand cricketers, they'll obviously say that Australian cricketers are quite dumb. But there's a sort of arrogance in being dumb, if you know what I mean, because you don't know what you don't know. And the Australian cricketers do believe, and I'm not taking a piss here, they do believe that there's sort of some spiritual birthright that they have picked up and that they are carrying forward, and a torch in a way that I've never seen in another cricket culture. And I don't know if that's just because they fucking dominated for 140 years, right? And, you know, it makes sense. Or if it's just part of Australian culture, but it's different. The other thing I would say about Australia is that because cricket developed differently in Australia than it did in, say, a lot of the other cultures are Little England, right? There's the class barrier is a big thing. And you know, you still see it in Asian cricket. You still see it in South African and New Zealand cricket at times. And Australian cricket developed in a much more team environment, right? So Australian rules football is really important in cricket, and rugby league as well. But Australian rules football is certainly very important. Australian rules football comes out of, it was a sport invented to keep the cricketers fit in the winter, right? But it's a sport where all you have to do is sacrifice. Like, a lot of when you're playing Aussie rules football, you are moving off the ball for other people the whole time. There's 18 of you on a field, and only one ever has the ball, right? So 17 of you are doing something else at any one time. And then when the other team's got the ball, all 18 of you are doing something else. Mm-hmm. There is an element that I don't think can be underestimated, that Australian cricket is a little bit more team centric than other sports. Mm-hmm. But again, where some of this is just nonsense cod psychology, right?
Doesn't make sense.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I get that. And I can tell you that as someone who's done the history of cricket, that those things matter. But also, cricket is a sport that is played in an individual way. Essentially, you have the ball in your hand, someone has the bat in their hand. So I don't know how much any of these things matter. Right?
I mean, they're perceived as mentality monsters. I've been on a fair few shows now. That's the narrative that's being peddled, right? That, oh, Australia is so mentally strong. And maybe there is some truth to that
as well.
But
people have been saying this team was mentally weak. They've been saying that Pat Cummins is a woke snowflake, right? And that without Langer, they're not alpha men. And they just upset. India are probably the best team ever not to win a World Cup. Right.
Quick question. Australia played a World Cup final versus the great West Indies team in the 70s. I can't recall if it was 75 or 79. Were they bigger underdogs then or in 2023 versus India? So they had to be big underdogs back then too.
It was 1975 World Cup final. Is that the one? I don't...
Maybe.
Yeah, 1975 World Cup final they played. And that's when Clive Lloyd goes nuts, makes that incredible 100. And then you've got, what was the, and then 1979, whoa.
Cup. Was England and West Indies.
Is England, isn't it? Yeah, because Australia. I'm trying to remember, is that the, because I think they had a big semi-final. Was it Gary Gilmore? So 75, the problem with 75 is it would be like saying that there was a favourite for the 2007 World T20 final, a World T20 tournament. Fair. Do you know what I mean? Like, no one knew anything. Yeah. So it's like, maybe it's that inaugural team's good. So, yeah. We don't know. 79 would have been a bit different because, the difference of the 79 team, and it does, on a podcast like this, it deserves to be mentioned. The West Indian team was Greenidge, Haynes, Richards, Calatrand, Lloyd, Collis King, who was probably one of those role players I was talking about before, Derek Murray, and then the four bowlers were Roberts, Garner, Holding, Croft.
Wow.
Like, that's kind of when a lot of those guys, maybe Richards wasn't at his peak, but you know, some of those guys were around their peak period. Actually, Richards might have been around his peak. He had a long peak. That was an incredible side. And so if you look back at 1983, just to finish this with the in India side of this, because they're a part of this one, even if they don't want to be, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, they're part of this Australian narrative. So West Indies side there was Greenidge, Haynes, Richards, Lloyd, Gomes, Farood Backus, Jeff Dujon, Marshall, Roberts, Garner, Holding. That's probably, if India wasn't the best team ever to lose a World Cup final, that is probably the best team ever to lose a World Cup final, because New Zealand didn't even make it in 92. And though I think if Australia had, you know, played one of those teams, but they never made it to either of those finals, that would have, you know, that would have changed the narrative, as you were just saying a little bit there. But look, it's just, I don't know what to say, because one day cricket now is such in a weird place that India played the most ODIs between these two World Cups. They really tested their frontline players. They really knew exactly what their depth chart was. They changed the way they played. They thought about it. They came in with a clear plan. They didn't lose a game all the way through. Australia dropped their wicketkeeper after two balls. Australia, after two games, literally did not know what was going wrong. Australia, halfway through the first innings of Sri Lanka, looked like they were going to go home from this tournament without making the finals. And yet here we are again, Bairam, and they've won the sixth title. And it's just, the whole thing is stupid. They are stupid good. And, you know, we're just going to have to leave it there. I'm going to say one last thing, actually. If this is the last 50-over World Cup, I am glad Australia won it, because it's their format. Kerry Packer, Bob Simpson as the coach in 87, 99, 2003, 2007. One day cricket is Australia. Even if the Asians took it over in the 90s and it became their format and everything else, one day cricket exists the way it is because of Australia, the way it is played, the way it looks and everything. So if this is the last 50-over World Cup, which we both think it won't be, but it's certainly a possibility, I think it's fitting that Australia has won it. And you know, in fact, as an Australian, being that we've won so many, maybe we just stop it here and we just always remembered as the team that won it the most.
Six World Cups is insane, and there's no doubting the fact that Australia have been the most dominant side. I mean, one could make an argument for all of cricket, but certainly one day cricket, that's for sure. And I mean, yeah, it must be or must feel great to be an Australian cricket supporter. I certainly cannot relate.
There's only one cricket team better than Australian men, and that's the Australian women. So,
yeah. I mean, Mitch Stark and Alyssa Healy have, what, 12 trophies now?
I don't even want to know. I mean, where would they even put them all, right? Like, I mean, they must have. I remember going to Srisant's house, right? And he had like this little room that was like all the trophies he won in his life. If those two had all of their trophies, right, they would need a separate house, right? It would be like, what's that? Helena Bonham Carter and Tim Burton, where they had like two houses next to each other. Like Alyssa Healy and Mitch, they would need like literally one house for their trophies and one house for them. It's a ridiculous, the whole thing's ridiculous. We're literally like, and what happens if those two breed?
Yeah. I mean, and then if you throw in Ian Healy, well, I don't think he has a World Cup, actually. But
he was pretty good,
he's
too.
He's also part of this. Yeah, he's part of the same family, right? Last question, and then we call it a night, right? There have been 5 World Cup winning captains for Australia. Alan Border, Ricky Ponting, Steve Waugh, Michael Clarke, Pat Cummins. Rank them.
Ooh. It's funny, actually, because you the most attacking captain Australia probably had in that, or the two most would probably be Clark and Taylor. Taylor never won a World Cup because in 96 they lost. Border and Steve Waugh are quite defensive captains, and Pat Cummins is quite a defensive captain as well. So if you're talking strategic, and Ponting as well. So if you're talking strategically, Clark is certainly the best strategic captain. But if I ranked him as number one, I'd never be allowed to go back to Australia. I mean, Ponting's 1-2, right? So he probably goes first. A part of me will give Alan Border the second ranking just because he rebuilt Australian cricket, right? And his bloody-mindedness, along with Bob Simpson's, you know, incredible cricket brain, was a big part of the reason that Australia got better. Of course, McGrath and Warne helped, but even before that, they were improving under Border. So I'd probably put Border at 2. I would then have to have Steve Waugh, I think, at 3.
And
then,
I mean, popular opinion would probably have Waugh at 1. He's a really popular captain, you know, cricket folklore and stuff like that.
Yeah, I never thought he was that good a captain. I just thought he had a really good team. I mean, I'm not saying he was a bad captain, but his team was pretty, I mean, outside of Cummins' team, you would have to say it was the most sort of out of there. They didn't know what they were doing, right? So I find it hard to put him up too high, but because of the way he played, he certainly goes above. And then I would probably say Clark, because Clark's team was certainly running. I know he's playing at home, and they were a better team, I think, at that stage than this 2023 team were. I would probably put Clark and then Cummins on that list. But honestly, the truth is, if you compare them to Arjuna, like Sri Lanka's won 1 World Cup, and I would have Arjuna above everyone else on that list. Dhoni's won 1 World Cup, and I'd put him above the other guys on that list, right? Australia, and I think this comes back to the teamwork thing before. I think some of the other teams, Imran, right? They've had like a spiritual leader who guides you through. I think Australia just plays as better as a team. And, you know, it really is. It's about the ability to have match winners and the ability to have Mike Valletas. You know, and that is probably what the true spirit of Australia is. That's not to say that Alan Border isn't incredibly important. And Steve Waugh as well. You know, are not incredibly important people in Australian cricket history, but it's not the same, if we're being honest.
Yeah. I mean, it's that cohesive nature of Australian cricket because of which normal blokes like Pat Cummins are such successful captains at this point, right? And he's so vanilla, but I love that about him. I love how Pat Cummins is like just dry, doesn't really care much, has some interesting press conferences because whenever people try to push his buttons, you can never push Pat Cummins' buttons. They don't exist, right? But anyway, I think that wraps this up. Of course, a marathon podcast once again. We're really tired. We've been podding for, 4 hours, I think, at this point. So if you like this episode, of course, you know, everyone who was listening and tuned in on video, throw us a comment, subscribe to this channel, subscribe to Jared's other channel. Thanks for all the love. We'll be back with Footmarks episode 28 next week. That'll be all for today. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are many other extras as well, including a please review, subscribe, and tell all your friends about our show. Word of mouth is the best way of making our podcast grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bharat Sundaresan and Bayram Kazi. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston. Each episode is produced by Ishit Kuberka at Sound Potion Studio. The team from 42 help us out with the video side. Orajoti Senapayu and Maida Akam, both producing podcasts, while Mukunda Bandredi is the head of our YouTube content. Feeling lazy about promoting your podcasts and videos? Memento FM has your back. Their seamless platform cuts and promotes all your content effortlessly. It's laziness approved. Try Memento FM today.